The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And this is Time Magazine. Today's program is supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest Insurance Group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the December 8, 2025 edition of Time Magazine. Today's edition, as usual, is bordered in red on the front cover with a narrow white inner border. Time, in large block capital lettering, is in gray. It's nearly absorbed by a black and bright green background. It looks like the head and shoulders of a turtle. Let's see what the caption reads. Ultraviolet light reveals a human handprint on the shell of a green sea turtle, demonstrating a cutting-edge technique that can be used for capturing forensic evidence against poachers and animal traffickers. And that photo is by Brita Yashinsky. It is a dark background with the bright green fluorescence. What I saw of a head and shoulders of a turtle is the green sea turtle, but it looks blue in this light. In fact, it looks various shades of blue, from a dark gray blue to a green blue to a bright, I'm going to call it mint, but mint isn't usually associated with blue, but it's just a bright shade of blue. And somehow it's been positioned in this place of dark black with the bright green contrasts. The first article is within the brief section. It is the Epstein Reversal by Philip Elliott. In the file release bill, Trump confronts losing his grip on the movement he started. Again, that's by Philip Elliott, with reporting by Brian Bennett. Donald Trump read his situation with a clear eye and pivoted. As autumn deepened, he was hemorrhaging support among Republicans over his obstinance on releasing all the files the Department of Justice had swept up in its investigations of disgraced financier and convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. The president's efforts to deflect were being met with equal parts outrage and ridicule. Trump faced a choice: shift his stance to align with those he had spent a decade nurturing, or stay defiant and pledge to veto a disclosure bill if it ever got to his desk. This was not a fight he could win through simple bravado. So in response to pushback from his own base, Trump blinked. The House on November 17 passed the Release It All bill with only one no vote, and the Senate followed unanimously hours later, and Trump did not take long to sign it into law. It may be a sign that the Make America Great Again movement is outgrowing the man who built it into a dominant political force. Representative Thomas Massie, a Kentucky Republican who forced the issue over the wishes of GOP leadership, cast the win as one for the forgotten man who made Trump's comeback possible. My quest to force a vote on releasing the Epstein files is not about incriminating the president, Massie says. For years, MAGA was whatever Trump said it was. His followers shifted their positions, sometimes repeatedly, on issues like trade, foreign conflicts, and who counted as a political enemy, based on what Trump said was MAGA orthodoxy. but the latest turn in the Epstein saga may presage a bigger development than a mere political slapdown. It may indicate the Make America Great movement is evolving beyond fealty to an individual, morphing from a cult of personality into a more fully formed ideology that could actually outlast its founder. That is not at all unusual. The MAGAverse formed around Trump, but may prove no more than a monolith than the Student Non-Violating Coordinating Committee was in the 1960s. Movements as different as the Tea Party and Black Lives Matter are themselves different today from when they started. Beliefs harden, tactics shift, loyalties are tested. A leader who does not read the room will suffer the consequences. Ideology is stronger than argument, and power proves portable. The Epstein saga stewed for weeks till November 12, when Democrats forced Trump's hand with the release of three combustible emails in which Epstein alleged Trump had spent hours with one of the victims, and of course he knew about the girls. Hours later, House Republicans responded with 20,000 other messages obtained from the Epstein estate. Trump's effort to swerve November 14 by appointing a special prosecutor to go after Epstein's connections to former President Bill Clinton, his Treasury Secretary Larry Summers, and big banks gained zero traction. So 2 days later, the president took the only off-ramp available. He said he wanted House Republicans to pass the bill, blessing an action that had proved unstoppable. When Trump first seriously started his climb in politics back in 2015, it seemed as if his populism and nationalism were merely vehicles for his brand. A formidable block of Americans seemed bewitched by the messaging that the elites were pulling a fast one. Those voters explained away his pressure campaign against Ukraine to find dirt on a political rival, dismissed his role in the violence that consumed the U.S. Capitol January 6, 2021 as overblown, eventually rationalized that returning Trump to power would allow him to finish what he'd started in his first term. Grace was limitless until it was not. To be fair, Trump's story on Epstein repeatedly shifted. First, no real link existed between the two New York playboys. Then came the argument Trump did not know anything but still found reason to kick Epstein out of his Palm Beach, Florida club. Then tales about fights over poached staffers and pilfered properties, and the details grew more specific. Trump disavowing a lewd drawing and a birthday wish that may every day be another wonderful secret. Then came the Democrats' emails, and then the Republican ones. By the end, Republicans were exhausted. Over the summer, House Speaker Mike Johnson sent his chamber home rather than allow a vote to come to the floor on releasing the Epstein files. During the six-week shutdown, he refused to swear in a duly elected House member because she would be the trigger that would force the House to take up the Epstein bill. Even for some MAGA diehards, this posture became too hard. Some rebel GOP lawmakers like Massey saw real value in knowing what the government had. Others let it be known they did not appreciate being lied to. And yet others were willing to lose Trump if it meant justice. In that moment, the president looked not only out of step with his base, but also at a loss for how to shape it. Trump may have finally succeeded in forming a movement that can outlast him. He is all the weaker for it. Again, that was written by Philip Elliott with reporting by Brian Bennett. Fighting for the planet. Here's a photograph, nearly half a page. It's in color. It shows two individuals who look like they've been in a tussle because there are other people pulling them apart. They're both brown-skinned. They're wearing feather headdresses. One is predominantly orange-red with some blue feathers. The other is predominantly blue with some orange feathers. A lot of skin is showing here, including some tattoos and what looks like a braided, beaded, not necklace, but something around one individual's neck. There are people in the background, too, that appear to be shouting. One guy is in black swim trunks or some kind of athletic performance trunks, and he is shouting right between these two people who are being held away from one another. Fighting for the planet, the caption reads, a staff member from COP30, the UN Climate Change Conference, holds back an indigenous protester November 11. One of thousands of climate activists who gathered outside the International Summit in Belém, Brazil, that ended November 21. Demonstrators called for participating countries to take greater steps to combat climate change and protect the Earth. The bulletin, U.S. strikes on boats prompt rethink on sharing intel. This is by Callum Sutherland. By the way, the photograph does not credit the photographer, so moving on to the bulletin. The U.S.'s relations with some of its allies have come under strain amid the Trump administration's military campaign targeting boats in the Caribbean, with some countries suspending or curtailing the way they share intelligence with Washington. The development comes as President Donald Trump's actions in the region have drawn criticism from the UN Human Rights Chief Volker Turk, and even some in his own party, like Indiana Senator Todd Young. Since September, at least 80 people have been killed in over 20 missile strikes on vessels in the Caribbean authorized by the administration. Trump argued the military action is necessary to curb the flow of narcotics into the U.S., but the government has not released any evidence indicating the targeted ships were smuggling drugs. Trump has said some of the vessels were manned by members of the Venezuelan cartel Tren de Aragua, which he claims is controlled by Venezuela's president Nicolas Maduro. U.S. intelligence analysts reportedly disagreed with this assessment in February. Maduro has accused the U.S. of fabricating a new war by expanding its naval presence in the Caribbean Sea. November 11, Colombia's President Gustavo Petro directed all public security forces to suspend the sending of communications and other dealings with U.S. security agencies. He added, such a measure will be maintained as long as the missile attack on boats in the Caribbean persists. Colombia is not alone. The UK reportedly suspended sharing some intelligence with the Pentagon because of concern over the boat strikes, according to CNN. A UK government spokesperson said the US is our closest ally, but declined to comment on intelligence matters. and Dutch intelligence officials told De Volkskrant newspaper in October they were restricting sharing information with U.S. counterparts over concerns on the politicization of intelligence. Turning the page to the brief news, good question. What would 50, that's 50, year mortgages mean for buyers, by Chantel Lee? The Trump administration has begun promoting the idea of 50-year mortgages as a way to make homes more affordable for buyers, a plan that has drawn criticism even from some of the president's allies, and that experts warn could come with potentially major drawbacks. President Trump floated the idea of introducing 50-year mortgages in a Truth Social post November 8. Soon after, Federal Housing Finance Agency Director Bill Pulte wrote in a post on X, "Thanks to President Trump, we are indeed working on the 50-year mortgage, a complete game changer." The longer-term mortgage would mark a significant extension on the most common type of home loan in the U.S., a 30-year fixed mortgage, which borrowers repay over three decades. Several right-wing commentators and lawmakers were quick to voice opposition to the idea, which Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene said in a post on X would ultimately reward the banks, mortgage lenders, and home builders, while people pay far more in interest over time and die before they ever pay off their home. The Trump administration's proposal also generated criticism from housing experts who say the benefits to home buyers would be minimal. The obvious reason to talk about a 50-year mortgage is that the monthly payments would be lower than those for a 30-year mortgage, according to Alex Schwartz, professor of urban policy at the New School, who walked time through the pros and cons. Imagine, for instance, a person is purchasing a $500,000 home with a 30-year mortgage. The current average interest rate for a 30-year fixed mortgage is about 6.22%, according to Freddie Mac. That means if the home buyer made a down payment of 20%, their monthly payment of the loan's principal and interest combined would be $2,455, according to Fannie Mae's mortgage calculator. But if the buyer took out a 50-year mortgage, again with a down payment of 20%, then their monthly payment of principal and interest, assuming that the interest rate is the same, would be $2,171, according to Fannie Mae. That is a little under $300 less than the monthly payment for a 30-year mortgage. It is a reduction, but it is not dramatic, Schwartz says, of the difference between monthly payments. He also notes that in practice, the interest rate for a 50-year mortgage likely would not be the same as that for a 30-year mortgage, which could reduce the potential savings. A higher interest rate is just one of a few possible drawbacks to a 50-year mortgage, he says. Another is that buyers would be in debt for longer. If you were 30 years old and bought a home with a 30-year mortgage, it would be owned free and clear at age 60, so you would only have to pay property taxes and maintenance on the home, no longer having to pay a mortgage during your older years or retirement, Schwartz says. If you are now paying a loan for a 50-year mortgage and you are 30, the mortgage would not end until you are 80, and so you would have a period of time, most likely during retirement, where you have to pay the debt service costs on top of the property taxes and maintenance. The other issue, Schwartz says, is that homeowners would not build equity as quickly with a 50-year mortgage as they would with a 30-year mortgage. For the first several years of a mortgage, a homeowner is primarily paying interest. It takes several years before they actually start reducing their debt. Buyers with 50-year mortgages would be paying down their debt much more slowly compared with those with 30-year mortgages. And if housing prices go down during that time, people with 50-year mortgages may be more likely to be left in negative equity, meaning they'd owe more than their homes are worth. There are major trade-offs here, Schwartz says. Amid all the criticisms, the president has defended the idea. All a 50-year mortgage would mean is you pay less per month and over a longer period of time, Trump told Fox News in an interview that aired November 10. That might help, he said, a little bit. And here's the milestones page. Let's see, there are two actual columns. And 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 left-hand column short items. Starting with one of the larger columns, sentenced Sheikh Hasina to death. And that's Sheikh, S-H-E-I-K-H, Hasina, H-A-S-I-N-A. This is written by Callum Sutherland. Last year's deadly crackdown on a student uprising in Bangladesh led to the ouster of then Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina after 15 years in power. Now it may also lead to her execution. November 17, the former leader was sentenced in absentia to death for crimes against humanity. The UN estimated that up to 1,400 people were killed in the violent clashes. We lost control of the situation, Hasina said in a statement following the sentencing by a special tribunal, according to the AP. But to characterize what happened as a premeditated assault on citizens is simply to misread the facts. She's currently in exile in India, as is her former home minister, Asaduzzaman Khan, who was also sentenced to death. Bangladesh, which is governed by an interim body led by Nobel Peace Prize laureate Mohammad Yunus, has sought to extradite both to face trial. Died James Watson. Oh, that was written by Callum Sutherland. Died James Watson, co-discoverer of the structure of DNA. This is by Jeffrey Kluger. If it's true, as former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld once said, that a country goes to war with the army it has, not the army it wishes it had, so too is it true that a culture gets the heroes it gets. So you cannot have Charles Lindbergh without the Nazi sympathies. You cannot have Thomas Jefferson without the enslaving. And you cannot have Nobel laureate James Watson, who died November 6 at age 97, without his history of toxic remarks. Watson's Nobel, which he won in 1962 and shared with Francis Crick and Morris Wilkins, recognized their discovery of the double helix structure of DNA. They were celebrated at the time, but as the decades wore on, Watson's star dimmed. There was his 2007 remark that he was inherently gloomy about the future of Africa because of baseless beliefs about intelligence. There was his comment that some anti-Semitism is justified. There was his eugenic statement in 2003 that if you're really stupid, I would call that a disease, so I would like to get rid of that. Watson nonetheless did great things, though his and Crick's and Wilkins' achievement would be shadowed in another way, too. They got a leg up in their work in 1953 when they were shown a raw X-ray crystallography image of DNA made in the lab of Rosalind Franklin, a gifted chemist. The picture did not seal the deal on the structure of DNA, but it did send them down the research road that would reveal the double helix. Franklin, however, was overlooked by history, partly because she died in 1958, and Nobels are not awarded posthumously. Crick and Wilkins died in 2004, leaving Watson the sole representative of their legacy. Over the years, he made more disturbing comments on race and IQ, on women's place in science. In life, he passed up the chance to retract them. He no longer has that option. It is a fraught legacy, but it is the one he chose. And that was by Jeffrey Kluger. Now to the left-hand column with the shorter items, minted, the last American penny, November 12 in Philadelphia. The Treasury Department said in May it would wind down production because of the penny, production of the penny, because of the high cost. One wonders, as I editorialize, which I shouldn't, what's happening to all that leftover copper. Declined, a request to revisit the U.S. Supreme Court's 2015 ruling that legalized same-sex marriage by the court, November 10, approved the Trump administration's peace plan for Gaza by the UN Security Council, November 17, recorded about 300,000 confirmed and suspected cases of cholera so far this year in Africa, health officials said November 13. Officials said the continent is facing its worst outbreak in decades. Returned the body of Mini Godar, one of the four remaining hostages abducted during the October 7, 2023 attack that sparked the conflict in Gaza, the Israeli government said November 13. Ended the longest government shutdown in U.S. history, November 12, after President Donald Trump signed legislation that was passed by both the Senate and the House to fund most agencies through January. The brief business, where top U.S. leaders earn their stripes, by Charlotte Hugh, H-U. As the industries and companies driving the American economy change, new generations of leaders are rotated in to take the helm. To understand the formative experiences and paths of American leaders, Time and Statista analyzed the resumes of a diverse group of 4,800 of the most influential figures shaping U.S. society today. From policymakers and corporate executives to leading scientists, educators, and cultural innovators, the data set is updated yearly to include younger leaders in emerging fields. The result is 125 universities and 175 companies that make the most frequent CV appearances. Many leaders still start their journeys at the elite schools that stay at the top of this list year after year, reflecting the enduring influence of certain established universities in shaping future leaders. Harvard, Stanford, and MIT continue to rank in the top five, and their alumni continue to head the new wave of top companies in the U.S., like Amazon, NVIDIA, and AMD. Even as higher education faces criticism and political pressure, it is hard to deny that getting into an elite school can often set students up for future success and create socioeconomic mobility, not only through education offerings, but also through setting up shortcuts to leadership incubation firms after graduation. We are attracting leaders. When you have this ability to convene so many amazing people and industries here in New York, we give them a kind of a superhighway to leadership, says M.J. Noel Finn, Senior Vice President for Enrollment Management and Student Success at NYU, number 8. These leaders are not just replacing old heads at legacy companies, but forging paths in uncharted territories. Notable leaders from NYU include Alondra Nelson, who led generative AI policy at the White House and oversaw the release of the blueprint for an AI Bill of Rights under the Biden administration. Some have used their adaptable technical expertise to ride the wave of innovation, like Eric Schmidt, a graduate of UC Berkeley, number 7, who was formerly Google's CEO and now is a prominent voice influencing AI policy in Washington and the development of AI startups. But several new colleges were added to the list this year, mainly HBCUs, liberal arts colleges, and state universities, reflecting the increasingly diverse background of younger leaders. Morehouse College, number 111, an HBCU that first appeared on the list last year, boasts alumni like Senator Raphael Warnock, who not only was the first college graduate in his family, but also became the first black senator in the state of Georgia in 2021. While people can lead without going to college or by going to school online, Michael Gum, Director of Admissions and Recruitment at Morehouse, sees college education as an extra tool to leverage campus activities or established alumni networks in prominent places that can serve as career stepping stones. Using those networks, which is the biggest aspect to me in today's times, and the ability to build those connections, it has to start somewhere, Gum says. After college, leaders often use those connections to join long-established career pipelines at major consultancies like McKinsey, Deloitte, PwC, EY, and KPMG. Large, active alumni networks associated with these firms give new recruits a leg up on nurturing relationships with future clients and employers, putting them on a fast track to future leadership. However, Fortune reports that as AI disrupts consultancy as a field, company boards are starting to look less for a jack-of-all-trades and more for leaders with deep technical knowledge and STEM backgrounds. Still, McKinsey believes in its approach. Generative AI will change many things about business, but it will not change the importance of great leadership, says McKinsey Global Managing Partner Bob Sternfels. The individuals who will thrive will be those who set bold aspirations, invest in relationships with teammates, and bring creativity and empathy to every challenge. Well, there are 20 best companies for future leaders listed, and 20 best colleges for future leaders, and both of those are indicated as being the top 20. I will read them quickly, just their names. From 1 to 20, the top 20 best companies for future leaders: McKinsey & Company, IBM, Mass General Brigham, PwC, Goldman Sachs, Accenture, Deloitte, Procter & Gamble, Alphabet, Bank of America, Microsoft, KPMG, PepsiCo, J.P. Morgan Chase, Ernst & Young, Boston Consulting Group, Johns Hopkins Medicine, NASA, Johnson & Johnson, and Morgan Stanley. Many of those are located in New York City, and I will mention the one that's in North Carolina, and that's number 10, Bank of America, Charlotte, North Carolina. Now, the top 20 best colleges for future leaders, 1 through 20, Harvard University, Stanford University, Yale University, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Columbia University, University of Pennsylvania, University of California, Berkeley, New York University, Georgetown University, Princeton University, University of Michigan, Northwestern University, Cornell University, University of Chicago, Duke University, Dartmouth College, University of Virginia, Brown University, University of Southern California, and University of California, UCLA. The one that was in the list in North Carolina is number 15, Duke University, Durham, North Carolina. And the preceding text was slightly abridged. Turning the page, the brief news, health. The food pyramid may be back on the menu. By Chad DeGuzman. Early public nutrition advice came as a warning. Wilbur O. Atwater, a chemist and renowned nutritionist, wrote in a 1902 edition of the U.S. Department of Agriculture's USDA Digest Farmer's Bulletin that unless care is exercised in selecting food, a diet may result which is one-sided or badly balanced, that is, one in which either protein or fuel ingredients, carbohydrate and fat, are provided in excess. The evils of overeating may not be felt at once, but sooner or later they are sure to appear. Over the years, U.S. authorities have made recommendations on what Americans should eat, often with the help of visual aids. Now, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., President Donald Trump's Health and Human Services, HHS, secretary, may bring back a relic from the past to promote the latest advice. Bloomberg reported, the Trump administration is considering reinstating the food pyramid when HHS and the USDA jointly update the U.S. dietary guidelines in December. An HHS spokesperson said in November that Kennedy is committed to new dietary recommendations that are rooted in rigorous science and that the 2025 to 2030 dietary guidelines for Americans will be a big part of the Trump administration's commitment to make America healthy again. A USDA spokesperson said the updated guidelines will address the chronic disease epidemic plaguing our nation by prioritizing whole, healthy, and nutritious foods. The story of American dietary diagrams dates back to 1943, when the USDA issued dietary advice in the form of the Basic Seven, which dedicated three categories to fruits and vegetables, and one slot each to milk and milk products, meat, poultry, fish, and eggs, bread, flour, and cereals, and butter or fortified margarine. Notably, it did not recommend a portion size for each food group. In 1956, the Basic Seven was simplified to the Basic Four, organized into new groups, milk, meat, vegetable, fruit, and bread cereal, with rough daily serving suggestions for each group. In 1980, the USDA and HHS released the 7-point Dietary Guidelines for Americans. As the overconsumption of sugar, saturated and other fats, cholesterol, and sodium steadily gained recognition as risk factors for developing chronic diseases. To illustrate what a healthier diet would look like at the time, the USDA, in cooperation with the American National Red Cross, presented consumers with the food wheel, a pattern for daily food choices, in 1984. In 1992, the food guide was released in a pyramid format. The width of each pyramid level roughly indicated the proportion of food servings. At its base, the base of the pyramid, were bread, rice, cereal, and grains, which should have the largest servings. And at its apex were fats and sweets to be consumed sparingly. But even the pyramid drew flack for being broad and vague. To address those concerns, a new version was released in 2005 called My Pyramid. One word, My Pyramid. It was outfitted with stairs meant to remind Americans of the need for exercise, and its food divisions were flipped to the side in bands of varying colors to represent different food groups: orange for grains, green for vegetables, red for fruits, yellow for oils, blue for milk, and purple for beans and meats. In 2011, however, the U.S. abandoned the food pyramid in favor of what it called My Plate, one word, My Plate, which indicated an average diet should be half fruits and vegetables, and roughly a quarter each for grains and protein. A smaller plate to the side was for dairy. Oh dear, the dairy producers were left out. Kennedy has advocated against ultra-processed foods, blaming them for causing chronic diseases and obesity. Many nutritionists agree, but he's also shared food misinformation, like claims about seed oils' toxicity, and experts are watching warily. Kennedy's also indicated that the full guidelines his agency issues will be just a few pages long. Kevin Klatt, a research scientist in the Department of Nutritional Sciences and Toxicology at the University of California, Berkeley, says that reflects a misunderstanding of the role of the dietary guidelines, which are intended as a policy document, not a guide for the public. As for the visual aid, sources told Bloomberg that it is expected to focus on protein and whole foods. The exact details on what it will look like are reportedly still being triangulated. The brief health: 5 migraine symptoms that are not headaches, by Angela Haupt. Nearly 40 million people in the U.S. suffer from migraines, making the painful disorder one of the most common that neurologists treat. It's also among the most confusing because of the many ways it can show up. It can take more than a decade to receive an accurate diagnosis. The general concept about migraine in the common population is that it's a headache syndrome, says Dr. Hamid S. Hamdi, a neurologist who heads the headache clinic at UT Health Houston Neurosciences in Sugar Land, Texas. And certainly many migraine sufferers, though not all, experience a throbbing headache. Beyond that, however, people don't know about all the other symptoms that migraine can cause, so they're very surprised in the beginning, he says. Even as neurologists, we don't always attribute those symptoms to migraine until we've ruled out things like a stroke. We asked Hamdi and other neurologists which non-headache migraine symptoms they see most often. Again, these are the non-headache migraine symptoms. There are 5. Food cravings is one. The couple of days before developing a headache, people typically enter the prodrome, early phase, of a migraine. Surprisingly, many report food cravings, especially for salty foods, sweets, and chocolate. The way scientists think about this kind of craving has evolved. While some once believed that foods like chocolate caused migraines, research suggests that is not the case, and there's no reason for people to avoid them. Generally, it was believed chocolate could trigger a migraine, Hamdi says. But what we believe now is that it's not chocolate that triggered it. It's that people were having a craving for chocolate as a prodrome of migraine. 2. Vision changes. About 20% of people with migraines experience a visual aura or temporary changes in vision. These can show up as shimmering spots, zigzag lines, blind spots, tunnel vision, or even temporary blindness. Visual aura is likely caused by a wave of electrical and chemical activity that spreads across the brain. People have described it all different ways, says Dr. Thomas Bravo, a neurologist and director of the Headache Center at Loma Linda University Health in California. It can be disturbing to a patient if it's the first time, but once they know it's linked to their migraine and will pass within an hour, it's not quite so scary. 3. Sensory sensitivity. Again, these are all symptoms that are non-headache migraine symptoms. Sensory sensitivity. Migraines are often accompanied by increased sensitivity to light, sound, and smells. The scents you are exposed to every day may strike you as much stronger and more putrid than usual, for example, and can be anywhere from unpleasant to actually painful, depending on the person, Bravo says. You also might find you cannot stand even the gentlest touch. Some people experience tactile allodynia, which happens when the central nervous system becomes extra sensitive to things that touch your skin. 4. Motor changes. Hemiplegic migraines, which are rare but serious, are associated with motor changes like one-sided body weakness or paralysis. This type of migraine has a strong genetic component and is often passed down from a parent. Basically, your face, arm, and leg get weak during the migraine attack, and then it goes away afterward, says Dr. Brian Gerhardstein, a neurologist and director of headache medicine at JFK Neuroscience Institute in New Jersey. It can look exactly like a stroke, so a lot of these patients end up in the emergency room. Seeking urgent care is a good idea, Gerhardstein adds. Since it's important to rule out potentially life-threatening conditions. And 5, abdominal pain. An abdominal migraine can cause a terrible stomach ache, nausea, vomiting, and a lack of appetite. People vomit over and over and over, Gerhardstein says. While there are different theories for why this happens, research suggests it's likely related to changes in the gut-brain axis. These gastrointestinal symptoms are common among kids and can be hard to diagnose, especially if young patients do not have a headache or are unable to articulate that they do. I see pediatric doctors scratching their heads, trying to figure out what exactly is going on, Gerhardstein says. When they've ruled out all the more organic causes, they've come to migraine as the final diagnosis. Review by Judy Berman, A Seductive, Dangerous Liaisons Remix with Feminist Intentions. This would be from the Time Off Television columns. The Seduction airs Fridays on HBO Max. I may need to abridge this slightly. There are no heroes in Les Liaisons Dangereuses. Pierre Choderlos de Lacoste, 1782 novel of end-stage French aristocratic decadence. Its chief villain is Marquise Isabelle de Mertuis, a master manipulator who exploits her former lover, the Vicomte de Valmont's resurgent desire for her with a wager that dooms them both. As a teenage Fiona Apple dryly noted, it's a sad, sad world when a girl will break a boy just because she can. The seduction, HBO Max's deliciously acted, baroquely libidinous yet sneakily substantive first French-language series fleshes out that world, created by Jean-Baptiste Delafont and directed by Jessica Palou. It centers Mertuis, adding backstory that recasts her as a hurt woman fighting for the freedom men enjoy. A fairy tale cold open sees the young heroine, a magnetic Anna Maria Bartolome, flee a convent to marry her beloved, a union consummated with swooning tenderness. Then the credits roll. She awakens alone. Her husband does not exist. The man she slept with is really the rake, Valmont. Vincent Lacoste, brooding like a Gallic Jeremy Allen White, who invented an identity and orchestrated a sham wedding just to get her into bed. On the brink of suicide, she elects instead to penetrate the libertine circle of Valmont's aunt and accomplice, Madame de Rosamond, Diane Kruger, ascending the aristocracy to torment the man who humiliated her. The aging Rosamond has her own reasons for making this alliance. Rejected by her cruel lover, the Comte de Gercourt, Emily in Paris's Lucas Bravo, she plans to use the noble newcomer as a bargaining chip. And so the game of musical bedchambers begins. The seduction teems with female gaze revelry. This is historical, bodice-ripping done right, with the occasional lost-in-translation moment. Maybe Hallelujah is not yet a soundtrack cliché on the continent. Philosophy is as French as romance, though. The show grounds its hedonism in the epiphany that especially for women under patriarchy, sex can be an expression of love or a way of exerting power. But things get messy when you confuse the two. While one requires vulnerability, the other forbids it. And both paths to liberation become prisons. Well, that was read in its entirety, but this won't be. Time Off Television Review by Judy Berman, The Journalist and the Jinx in a Suburban Standoff. Claire Danes gets a lot of attention for her cry face. It is indeed a sight to behold. Engulfed by waves of sorrow, her chin vibrates, her eyes scrunch, the corners of her mouth turn down as though tugged by invisible weights. But the crying is just an extreme expression of Danes' greatest asset, her ability to convey abjection. This quality shaped her performances in roles as different as My So-Called Life's angsty teen, Angela Chase, and the doomed female lead in Romeo Plus Juliet, the bipolar CIA agent in Homeland, and the Manhattan supermom of Fleshman Is in Trouble. Even surrounded by misfit buddies or concerned colleagues, her characters feel wholly, miserably, but also somehow relatably, alone. Loneliness happens to be the defining attribute of Dane's latest antihero, Aggie Wiggs, the Pulitzer-winning journalist at the center of the Netflix cat-and-mouse thriller The Beast in Me. Still racked with grief years after her young son's death in a car crash, divorced from the wife with whom she was raising him, and paralyzed by writer's block, Aggie cannot let go of pain, for which she blames everyone but herself. She's the best character Danes, also an executive producer, has given us since Homeland's Carrie Matheson. And the ideally cast, impeccably paced, diabolically addictive 8-episode murder mystery that she anchors is one of the year's most suspenseful rides. Aggie is supposed to be writing a book on the unlikely friendship between Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Antonin Scalia. Instead, she's been moping around the crumbling Long Island money pit she used to share with her ex Shelley, Natalie Morales, and their little boy, Leonard Jerome, fixating on the possibly drunk young driver, Teddy Bubba Weiler, she believes caused the accident. This holding pattern is broken by the arrival of a new neighbor, Niall Jarvis, a notorious real estate mogul played by Matthew Rhys, cleared of his late wife Madison's, Layla George, murder. But presumed guilty by the court of public opinion, Niall has moved into the estate next door to Aggie with his new wife, Nina Brittany Snow, and he's a fan of Aggie's work. But Niall is unimpressed by her current project, which she describes as a balm for a polarized society. No one wants hope, he scoffs. They want gossip and carnage. If you want another bestseller, you should write about me. Aggie's surprised he'd be open to that. He seems to trust her, though, because he identifies with her. In her rage at Teddy, Niall perceives what he calls bloodlust. This, understandably, disturbs Aggie. Yet this book project does sound more compelling than her current one. As multiple storylines unfold surrounding FBI agent Brian Abbott's, David Lyons, off-the-clock pursuit of Niall, Abbott's affair with his supervisor, Hetty Ann Park, and Niall and his father Martin's, Jonathan Banks, controversial Manhattan construction project, Jarvis Yards, the question of whether Niall is really a murderer bleeds into Aggie's soul searching. That article was abridged. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine, which is generously supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.